Nicholas Meyer, and I'm the writer-director of Time After Time. The Warner Brothers shield is there because I stuck it there over the vociferous objections of everybody because I said their previous logo looked like something you stamp on office furniture, and it wasn't fun. And I said, and this movie should be fun, and I want to bring back the shield and the Max Steiner fanfare. By the time of the preview, that shield came off the screen and everybody started to yell and scream, and it's been on every picture since.
Brilliant. Hello, I'm Malcolm McDowell, and I play H.G. Wells in Time After Time.
I went to the University of Iowa, where I made friends with a playwright named Carl Alexander, who was living in Los Angeles, as I was, and approached me with 55 pages of a novel he was writing called The Time Travelers, which he said was loosely inspired by my novel, The 7% Solution. He asked me if I would read his novel and critique it. I read it, critiqued it, and optioned it because I thought it would make a swell movie. I wasn't too concerned about which direction his book was going, and I just loved his central idea, which he apparently had co-written with another writer named Steve Hayes. I took that idea, and I wrote the screenplay that I wanted, brought it to my friend Herb Jaffe, who was a respected producer in town, now lamentably deceased, and said, you know, this is basically so simple, they'll have to let me direct it, because it won't be expensive. What I said to everybody was, look, I don't know anything, so you're going to have to mind, you're going to have to teach me, and then you're going to have to not mind teaching me, and then you're going to have to not mind if I still want to do it my way after you've given me the benefit of your expertise. And if anybody could withstand that catechism, they were on. So as the movie went along, I got bolder and bolder with my own ideas. But I had, as I say, certain philosophic approaches from the beginning, like not seeing a knife go into anybody.
How I got the film was that I was in Rome doing... finishing up this film Caligula, that I was playing a Roman emperor, and I was sick of gory, violent sex scenes. I'd had it up to there, you know, and along came the script Time After Time. I thought it was beautifully written by Nick. I was very happy to be asked to do it, because it was a change of pace for me, and I was thrilled and excited to come to Hollywood to make a film, and it was indeed my first film in Hollywood, in America, in fact. And so that was great for me. And I had a wonderful time here. I didn't quite realize that I'd end up with a wife and two children from this film, but that's basically how it went for me. That's a good old Warner Brothers backlot street.
It was the way it's been for 100 years of staging Victorian pieces in Burbank, California. That's the great thing about Burbank, California and the studio system. My director of photography was Paul Lohman, who used to be Robert Altman's cinematographer. This was the first time the CinemaScope, the Panavision people gave us a 50mm 1.1 lens. It was the first time it was ever used was in this movie. They've gone way beyond those things since, but gave us a much greater depth of field and definition in the background. Don Cambron, who edited Easy Rider and many, many other films, was the editor of Time After Time, and Ed Carfagno, the production designer, also lists among many, many credits the 1959 Ben-Hur, for which I believe he won an Oscar. One of the things, being as this is a movie that has Jack the Ripper in it, it's not a movie, I'm not terribly interested in Jack the Ripper, except as a representative type of destructive humanity. I didn't want to make a gore movie. And I decided that I didn't want anybody to be seen sticking a knife in anybody else. The result of which turned out to be a lot more terrifying than if you had, as you're about to see. The music is from the Joseph Candaloube Songs of the Auvergne. There are many, many recordings of it with the singing on it. You see, there's nothing to see. It's all left to the imagination.
when I was asked to play H.G. Wells, I immediately called the BBC Archives Department to get a recording of his voice because I thought maybe that would be useful for me. And the BBC kindly lent me this very scratchy old 78 record, and I listened to it, and I was absolutely horrified. H.G. Wells had the most horrendous, high-pitched Southeast London accent. He sort of talked like that. And I thought, well, if I go to Hollywood and talk like that, I don't think they're going to understand it. So I thought we'll put that one to rest. And so I forgot all about that and just played, really, what was in the script. And I do remember when it came out in London, I was heavily criticized for playing H.G. Wells the way I did it. But of course, you know, you have to play the character to serve the script. And that's the most important thing. You know, that's where my responsibility lies, is to serve the director and his script. So, but it's a great idea, isn't it, to use H.G. Wells, who, of course, is this futuristic writer and great socialist, you know, who wrote The Time Machine and all the all those wonderful books.
There was a big search. Originally, I thought about Derek Jacobi for H.G. Wells, having seen him in I, Claudius. And then I came up with an idea that I thought was just as good, maybe better, Malcolm McDowell. And they said, oh, but he always plays the villain, the bully boy. And I said, well, that's what will make this so good. He'll play the hero, and that's called acting.
I was known, of course, primarily through the part of Alex in Clockwork Orange, which is this sort of rather immoral hood. As soon as I read it, though, I wanted to do it.
And here is our baddie, David Warner.
Yes, David Warner. He's a wonderful actor, David.
They also were interested in having Mick Jagger play the Ripper, and I met with him. But the Ripper's secret identity, as you see here, is he's a Harley Street surgeon. And I didn't think Jagger would be persuasive as the Harley Street surgeon. Whereas David, you completely buy.
And I'm very pleased to see that he's come back to the stage now after many years, after 25 years. I think he just appeared in Major Barbara in New York, and he was absolutely brilliant. I saw the production last summer, and he's in great form. So it's really good to see David back. We were old friends. We were at Stratford together. Admittedly, he was a star at Stratford. I was a mere walk-on, as they say. There was, of course, lots of parties at Stratford and all the rest of it, and, you know. But David was, it was literally like the Beatles, you know. He'd come out of the stage door, 300 screaming girls, and I was at his shoulder, you know, to help him pick one, you know. And, of course, and who's your friend for me? Yeah, that was very important. But we were young, and we had a lot of fun. He was a magnificent Hamlet, a brilliant stage actor, and a wonderful, of course, he was a great film actor.
Electric Light, gentlemen.
The Ballad of Cable Hogue, a brilliant film directed by Sam Peckinpah. David played the preacher, right? He's absolutely brilliant. And he was brilliant in Morgan, A Suitable Case for Treatment, which is one of the classic British films of its time.
Free love has paid for most of it. Yes, I've no doubt.
This time machine was very much inspired by my great love of the Nautilus in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And I wanted it to be very Victorian and look like something that could be cobbled together in your basement. The Warner Brothers prop department made the time machine, and it was one of the big fights we ever had because it kept falling apart. And it was the only time I allowed myself, I think, to get really enraged on a movie. You'd open the doors and they'd fall off. And I said, you didn't take me seriously. You didn't take the movie seriously. You didn't do your job. And they knew I was right, too. I didn't get a lot of argument. Cosmetically, it is wonderful. A model of that time machine, I'm happy to say, sits in a Perspex case in my house.
Trade to the west, you gain yesterday. To the east, you accumulate tomorrow.
Balderdash. Go north, you get to Glasgow.
The machine is designed with several safety features. The reversal rotation lock automatically returns the machine to its starting date after the completion of a voyage. If the occupant...
I did another time travel picture called Just Visiting, or Les Visiteurs, you know, the French film, where the knights travel back and forth, and that was also great fun, but I think Nick got this right. H.G. Wells at the beginning is this pompous sort of English character, you know, and he's... I wanted to play up that side of him because of... to make the change when he comes to America, San Francisco, all the more marked.
This vaporizing equalizer. Without it, the passenger journeys through time without the machine. And without the machine, there is no coming back. Well, H.G., which is it to be, the past or the future?
Oh, the past, surely.
I have always been intrigued by chess. I'm not a very good chess player, but chess is a metaphor or a sort of representation of intelligence. Keeps cropping up for me. I like my villains to be good chess players. In another picture of mine, you learn that the villain actually beat the IBM machine. That's how you know how smart they are.
I do play chess. I enjoy it very much. I don't play so much now. I made the mistake of playing with Stanley Kubrick, who killed me in five moves, I think. So I stuck to ping pong with him, where he never beat me at ping pong. But at chess, he was a master.
Not changed for 2,000 years. We hunt, we're hunted. That's how it is. That's how it shall always be. The future will prove you wrong.
Film, for my way of thinking, or to my way of thinking, is a collaborative process. There's a desire on my part to work with everybody, not just in their official capacity, but if you're involved enough in what we're doing, to say, not just are the hems right on my costumes, but what do you think about these scenes? It's very European, and a lot of the Hollywood crews are very surprised when I turn to somebody and say, what do you think? And they go, well, the lighting was good, and I say, I know that. I'm asking about the scene. And here comes a very interesting line.
One day I shall win.
Yes, when you learn how I think.
Keep in mind that interesting exchange. Malcolm was very worried about wearing glasses in the movie. He said to me, I act with my eyes. And I said, I promise, your eyes will be seen. H.G. Wells wore glasses, and you will too. And besides, we'll have fun with these glasses. I believe that art thrives on restrictions. And later on, when we were making the H.G. Wells exhibit, I thought, oh great, we'll just take apart his apartment and we'll recreate elements of it in the exhibit. And then I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if he forgot something at home? And he could find it again at the exhibit.
No doubt about it, I'm afraid, gentlemen.
He has a very distinctive style.
What is there, Sergeant?
I think you'd better have a look at this, sir.
Every Englishman knows, you know, about Jack the Ripper. And there's been so many series, stories about him and all the rest of it. The first serial killer, of course he wasn't, but I suppose he was the first one that the police, you know, police force, of course, was in its infancy then, and, you know, they never really found the killer, and there was so much theorizing about who did it, and whether it was a member of the royal family, was a butcher, or, you know, the whole thing, or a surgeon, perhaps, and so it was always in the sort of psyche and the sort of Sherlock Holmes area.
We take the route, sir. There's no sign of him. Watch him back.
We know there was a Jack the Ripper. Yes, we know that. We know that H.G. Wells wrote a novel called The Time Machine. Yes, we know that. We also, all we're asked to believe, in a way, is that in addition to writing about this machine, he built it. And he hadn't quite worked up the nerve to use it, and somebody used it first, and it had a homing device, and once you accept those little things, you're off and running.
Thank you, dear. My embarrassment.
I've never been so frightened. That bag. I don't know how many times I've put it in the closet for him. I wonder he didn't take it with him when he left.
Then we'd never have known.
Here we come to this moment, which I treasure in the movie, because I had another line here that I had written.
could you find him?
Under my very nose, he said.
We were by the front door of the old town.
And after we filmed it, we broke for lunch, and a guy from up the Gators came down and said, "You're the writer of this thing, too, aren't you? Not just the director." And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, he said the wrong thing, if you're asking me." I said, "What should he have said?"
"When you learn how I think."
"When you learn how I think" goes back to the chess game. And I had, it was so much better than what, you know, under my very nose, that's such a stupid cliche line. But this to echo the exchange during the chess game, that was written by a guy, you know, miles up in the soundstage working a light. And I was very happy that that happened because, A, it improved the film, and B, it meant I was running the kind of set that I wanted to run where people could come up and make suggestions. I didn't want them made while I was working, while I was shooting, and I reserved the right to say no. But I wanted to hear them because I knew I needed all the help I could get.
Shaking the fangs, and I'm holding on. I'm sort of... I suppose the special effect budget now would be probably a lot more, but it's kind of sweet.
You know, this was before CGI. Star Trek II, which came afterwards, was one of the first movies to start using CGI material. And by the time I was... Actually, Star Trek VI, which I also did, had CGI effects. We might as well here talk for a second about the music of this film. The music for Time After Time was written by a Hungarian composer named Miklos Rozsa, whom Phil Buff will recognize as having written 100 movies, won the Academy Award 4 times. He wrote El Cid, King of Kings, Ben-Hur, Naked City, Asphalt Jungle, The Thief of Baghdad, Providence, Lost Weekend, Double Indemnity. It's a long list. After Ben-Hur, I guess in the 60s or the 70s, he sort of was considered to be maybe passé, and everybody was interested in pop scores. But I didn't want a pop score because this is a movie about a 19th century man. And I thought any pop music that is experienced should be experienced as source music, that is to say, coming from the world which he goes to visit. I wanted a 19th century symphonic score representative of Wells and what was going on with him. And also, I wanted it from somebody who had a gift for, you know, what I will imprecisely call fantasy. An operatic sensibility. I wanted the man who wrote The Thief of Baghdad to write this music. Warner Brothers didn't care for the score. They didn't care for the movie. They until it did all that business, and they liked it a lot. But they wanted to replace the score. And one of the things that we did was we took a full-page ad in Variety when the score was delivered to congratulate Miklos Rozsa on his music and say how much we loved it so that they would be reluctant to remove it. And I'm convinced that what you're about to see from the point of music completely bears out the wisdom of my decision.
The music is incredible. It's great.
I like to be right once in a while. This whole time travel sequence, I mean, visually is so much helped by what you're about to hear.
This is just out of shot, you know, just one of those things for lifting crates.
All that could have been much better, should have been, but who knew? Nobody minds it because you're so caught up in it, which goes back to sort of my original theory, which is that if you're having a good time and you're caught up in what's happening, and the picture stays in focus, and you can hear what they're saying. You know, unless the effects are egregiously ludicrous, and those weren't. They're just not top flight. And we just fiddled around.
Nick made me say, look over there now, look up at the thing, and it's whizzing around and all that. Going, what? What else do you want me to do? That sort of thing.
Idea, since no one knows what time travel is, and since other people would do this better than me anyway, and probably did before, was to reach the point of, you know, Mach, whatever it was, Mach 100, where you're not only, you're traveling so fast that you can't see at all, and I just used all the radio broadcasts that I could find, and we had much more, we had to keep whittling it down, so that what you're now hearing is a collection of classic radio, this is computer-generated imagery, I think it was a roll of toilet paper that we kept photographing.
First World War.
And the only thing I wanted from the images was that we always looked somehow as though we were going forward.
Is this something
we have to fear? Is the opportunity going to...
They're fighting towers.
To the attack Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
I showered.
This is London.
London.
Great choices, actually. This is all Nick. This is all in the script. I think this actually was in the script, a lot of this, as I remember.
Well, we were trying to make each one successively later. It was also a world that got increasingly violent.
The Israeli athletes were killed. Vietnam, ceasefire agreement.
Because of the Watergate matter.
Second test tube baby.
Corey Feldman, that child, who's now a very big, strapping young actor. And, yes, I remember that. Because he came up to me and said, I was in Time After Time. I was the little kid, you know, I remember.
Portrait of the public and private life of an extraordinary human being.
The voice on the tour guide is Shelley Hack, who later became a Charlie's Angel. There was a gag here that I kept trying to make work. That gentleman was in High Noon. He was the bartender in High Noon.
Yeah.
That Gary Cooper slugs. I was thrilled. He was the one who said, Marshall, you had no call to do that. You carry a badge and a gun.
Come on.
The business about his watch being caught on the hook was something I was trying to set up later at the end. Or something that happened to the Ripper, sort of being undone by time, as you might say. I didn't shoot it quite right. There were many things in this movie that I did not shoot right. The fact is, I'm not sure if it's clear to audiences why Wells and his machine and the Ripper wind up in San Francisco, not London. Because the machine hasn't moved. The machine was always in Wells' basement. But what did get moved were the entire contents of Wells's house to form this exhibit in San Francisco. In other words, the time machine didn't travel through space. This was all crated up and shipped. Here we come to the payoff, where his glasses are damaged. He's back among his own things. Very appropriate, very cost-effective, too. And he suddenly has the weird idea that maybe, just maybe, yes, his extra pair.
And there's the glasses. Ah, they fit. There you go. I think with playing this part, that you have to have this sort of innocence and ingenuous sort of feeling, but I guess the charm of this character comes through. That I hadn't had much practice at playing that sort of part, and on film. I've done it on stage, of course, and stuff, but I was known for these heavy parts, so this is such a nice, relaxed sort of move away for me, and I loved it. And also, the movement is very important. This character really is, it's very important about his movement, the way, you know, a movie is about movement, and there go the Hare Krishnas, you know. Imagine meeting them on the first time on the planet. What a shock that would be. Is he taking notes? Lovely.
Hello. I guess that's a fashion that never caught on, see-through trousers. But it certainly made our point.
The permissive society.
Everything he sees, everything he looks at, is science fiction. The film is very inexpensive because all the sci-fi hardware is in the minds of the audience.
Hey, what's
in my car? So I took all the locations from San Francisco that I like. Here, an incomprehensible headline, Colts Mall Rams. What does that mean to a man from 1893? It sounds like baby horses are beating up on goats. Originally, my prop man had put C Sports underneath it, and I said, no, don't. That just helps it out.
I beg your pardon. Could you please...
I had never been to San Francisco. I'm from New York. I lived there for a month when I came west to go to Los Angeles, and I fell in love with this city, as I'm sure everybody does who goes there.
I had actually been to San Francisco one time before, when I did a sort of trip promoting Clockwork Orange, and they put me in. We arrived there at night by car, having driven up the Coast Highway, and so I was put in this suite in the Fairmont Hotel. I had no idea where we were or anything, and it was a corner suite, huge place. And I remember in the morning opening the curtains and being completely amazed at the panoramic view of the whole of the bay, the bridge, Alcatraz, the whole thing. It was just so magnificent. I mean, it's a great city. To me, it's one of the great cities of the world. And to do this film there was so exciting.
And they would have sent him to me if he wanted to exchange pounds for dollars.
I see.
I think I went into every bank in San Francisco. There's a lot of banks there.
Big Mac, an order of fries, and a small Coke to go, please.
There was no product placement. Certainly not when I dreamt up the scene. It had nothing to do with product placement. As Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Unseen to go, please. Pommes frites. Fries of pommes frites.
This is quite fun.
I never saw wood like this before.
I think that was Nick wanted him to wear that deerstalker hat.
Amazing. I haven't seen stones and settings like these since before the war.
The war?
Since the Second World War, you know.
Did you say
World War? Since World War II, I said. How much are they worth?
To be honest with you, I'm looking at this and going, my God, it's good. I haven't seen this in many, many, many years.
I couldn't give you a tough time.
There were things I wanted to try even more. I mean, once he sees that people are tattooed with numbers, I had a thing where he thought everybody was tattooed with numbers. What's your number, you know? And he was going to, you know, look for her when he talked to her on her arm. But what I discovered in this movie is that if you put the setup too far from the punchline, nobody remembers the setup. And so by the time we got to him talking to her, everybody forgot about the tattoo.
I don't have some. I can't do business unless I have some identification. How do I know these aren't hot?
Hot?
Yeah, you know, stolen. Stolen?
I assure you, sir. I give you my word as a gentleman.
Come on, give me a break. What's this gentleman stuff? How come you don't got any ID? Look, let me do a computer check on the stuff. If it's clear, we can do business. In a week, you'll have a check.
I don't have a week.
Finally comes to the one place that he thinks will give him sanctuary. It looks familiar. It's Gothic cathedral.
I don't believe you exist. But if you do, I need your help. Just let me stay the night. I'll be on my way in the morning, not trouble you again.
Of course, he's even asked to move on, even in a church.
I'm sorry, we're closing now.
It's perfect. Now you get shoved right out.
Utopia.
Oh, this is the park right outside our hotel.
Yes. Wells was a brilliant man. Much of what he dreamed of and figured out or espoused as causes, women's rights, came to pass, and other stuff less so. We are shortly going to see a hotel, which is a rather remarkable hotel. In this scene, we learn that guns are omnipresent.
Now he's looking at guns. Ooh.
I probably should have done a close-up of the guns. There's a lot of close-ups missing in the movie. I didn't really understand. And that's Herb Jaffe coming through the door, but we never quite let him get through it. And this extraordinary building that you are about to see was designed by Julia Morgan. She was the architect of San Simeon for William Randolph Hearst. It's just such an amazing place. I trust that it is still preserved. We had a lot more, but it was always about cut down, keep the story moving.
Mary has the most off-the-wall delivery of any actress I've ever worked with, and very, very funny. This is her second film. She'd just done Going South with Jack Nicholson. And this was the one before Melvin and Howard, where she won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
I always imagined that the woman that Wells met in the movie would be a blonde, blue-eyed, fast-talking city chippy. And instead, I got a dark-haired, dark-eyed, slow-talking lady. But what I was really looking for was Jean Arthur. And somehow, Mary Steenburgen reminded me of a sort of laid-back Jean Arthur. She was not, she hadn't learned many tricks. She just only knew how to be. And you can see her falling in love with him from the get-go.
I guess we were falling in love during the whole shoot, actually. That's the truth. And I think I was a little more in love with her than she was with me. When this happened, it was out of left field, really. It was shocking for me. I think Mary says to the kids, you know, oh, that's our photo album of our romance. And actually, that's true, in a way.
I didn't know anything about it. In fact, I never knew anything about anything. I was just trying to get through every day. And somebody said to me, wow, look at these dailies. I think Mary's falling in love with Malcolm. I was the last person to find out that, you know, that they were falling in love. I just thought, what a great director.
Hyatt Regency?
The Hyatt Regency on Drum Street, which we chose for a reason, is a very famous H.G. Wells movie called Things to Come, based on a book of his called The Shape of Things to Come. I don't know if you're familiar with this movie, but it's an absolute must-viewing from a production standpoint. It was designed by the first great production designer of movies, William Cameron Menzies, and when you see the movie, you'll know why we picked the hotel. And when I looked at the hotel, I said, whoa. And we were talking to the lady who ran the hotel on our location scout. And I said, oh, we have to come here. Tell me about this. And he said, well, Mr. Portman, who's the architect of the hotel, his favorite movie was The Shape of Things to Come. And he wanted to make the William Cameron Menzies set come to life. So I said, so this really is the H.G. Wells Hotel. And he said, yes, it really is, she said. And that's why, you know, it just became a sort of an in-joke. It was used in another Warner Brothers film earlier by Mel Brooks in High Anxiety, same hotel.
With a very cute man.
Mm-hmm. That was a pickup. Against by whom?
I don't care. At least he's not gay. Plus, I love the way he talks.
How about that suit? Early American.
He'll be back.
The suit, which is a beautiful cashmere suit, actually. And very easy to move around in and work in. And even though it was very hot in San Francisco, it was, it didn't get too itchy, you know. It was pretty good.
This is our stunt driver, Gene Hartline, behind the wheel. After he figures out how to get in.
What's up, Doc?
I beg your pardon?
You were saying? Where to?
Could you please take me as quickly as possible to the Hyatt...
My partner, Steve Jaffe, shot second unit on this and did this bullet spoof. Makes you want to heave as you... Vertiginous shot. He's actually going in the right direction. This is the way to get to the Hyatt Regency on drum. I couldn't get enough of this hotel. I just wanted to do more and more and more. But this is all a dead ringer for the Shape of Things to Come.
Yes.
And speaking of dead ringers, here's Jack and the Money Belt.
This is a very, very good scene.
This was a set. We're back at Burbank now. And I think this was the first set I shot, and I had no idea how to shoot anything, so I'd say, well, let's take a picture of that, and then let's take a picture of that, and the guys would be standing around with funny expressions, and I said, well, what's wrong with that? And I said, well, it's easier to shoot when you're lit in one direction and then turn around and shoot lit in the other direction. I said, oh, how much time have we lost because we've been doing things...
Great. David's hardly a flicker. Brilliant.
They were in the Royal Shakespeare Company together, Malcolm McDowell and David Warner, when David was a star and Malcolm was a spear carrier.
I think of it, there was no way of preventing the machine from returning. I haven't the key.
No.
And you managed to find the nerve after all.
After I'd tested your machine for you.
And how did you manage to track me down once you'd got here? That was brilliant.
This is the scene which, you know, if there's any scene which is the reason for the movie... in thematic terms, here it comes. And what I loved about this movie was that I didn't have to stretch to make my point. I didn't have to lecture. I didn't have to rig it. All I had to do was say, here, let's turn on the television, and you tell me.
...intervened and forced me to ascertain for myself that you are truly the Columbus of a new age.
It's not very miraculously shot, I have to say, but here's an example. It's just... the people are there, they're saying what they're supposed to say, and they look right, so enough is enough. I mean, I'm sure a more accomplished or a more experienced director would have made this visually a more arresting moment. Doesn't matter, because we're busy.
There's also the fact that we knew each other, and so we went back many, many years to the beginning of our careers, really, beginning of his, beginning of mine, and so that to be working together in a foreign country, you know, to us, it was kind of amazing, especially on this sort of stuff.
And you can be sure that what he's about to show him now would be even worse today if you turn on the TV.
15 terrorists carried out their threat and began shooting the first five of 106 Israeli school children held hostage.
Could be the same news.
You haven't gone forward, Herb. You've gone back.
We've just received word that Mayor Griffin Margolin of Columbus, Ohio, was shot.
We don't belong here. On the contrary, Herbert.
CBS presents a special documentary.
I belong here completely and utterly. I'm home. It's you who do not belong here.
Well, that's TV.
With your absurd notions of a perfect and harmonious society. It's drivel. The world has caught up with me and surpassed me. 90 years ago, I was a freak. Today, I'm an amateur. You go back, Herbert. The future isn't what you thought. It's what I am. Do you know that you can go into a shop here and purchase a rifle or a revolver? It's perfectly legal. These people encourage...
Stop it!
To actually do that was a sort of a sign of a defeat for him. To do that is just horrendous. A terrible act.
Finding me here is rather fortuitous.
Fortuitous? Misuse of the word fortuitous. Another moment I'd like to take back. Fortuitous does not mean fortunate. It turns out it means accidental. I just thought fortuitous was like a more Victorian way of saying fortunate.
And to look at the way he's dressed, he's so harmonious with society now, and whereas Wells is ridiculous, you know, and out of date.
I don't have it with me. Herbert. Herbert, I've played countless games of chess with you, and the one thing you cannot do is bluff.
Any given scene in this movie, including this one, might have been better staged by a director with more experience. All the set pieces, the chases. Now, David says to me when we're about to shoot this, he says, by the way, he says, I have two broken ankles, so I can't run. I said, what? And I don't know what to do if somebody says this. Here's a great shot of the interior of the Hyatt and this elevator chase.
It's very much part of the energy of this character to do this movement and this whole chase and running down escalators and stuff.
That's David, and that's about as fast as David's going to be able to go.
Yeah, David's barely moving.
And that's a double. And what I liked about this place to stage my chase was that I didn't have to do it with automobiles, which I thought would be slightly beyond me. And besides, we were going to have a kind of an automobile chase later. So I like this labyrinth of this shopping center promenade where I could have just people sort of running around.
Yes.
See, he sort of tails off here.
Oh, yeah.
This was a shot I insisted we do. My cameraman said it'll never work. it's too far away. And then later we looked at it in dailies, and he said, oh, you were right, it was good. So that, I was starting to learn that I should sort of trust my instincts a little bit. Look at this. This was brilliant editing, because without the cutting, you wouldn't be able to see the next shot, which is both of them, but now you know where to look. So they're barely visible, but they're there. Here's more brilliant cutting by Don Cameron, who did Easy Rider. Watch, he's going to leap down those stairs, man. That's a brilliant jump cut. You can barely see it. And here's a stunt that I got right. Comes out of nowhere and looks real. And this emergency room was meant to be another vision of hell.
This always made me laugh. I said to him, what is this, Vietnam? I said, I've never been inside an ER where everybody's dying. There's a lot of blood in this ER.
Well, then wake up a little.
Is
there only one
door? I beg your pardon.
Oh, excuse me, baby. Yes?
I'm looking for a patient recently admitted less than an hour ago. He was in an accident.
Name?
John Leslie Stevens.
This is a piece of entertainment which is meant to... I mean, when you go to see a movie or a play or read a, or hear a piece of music, the object is to make you feel, not to make you think. If I start thinking while I'm watching the movie, that's not so good. If I think about what I watched later, that's very good. If it sort of sticks to the ribs of your mind, to make an anatomically clumsy metaphor. If you come out and think the story really captured you, and then you start thinking about what it all added up to. And as I say, this movie is five movies wrapped up in one. This is a thriller. This is a romance. This is a comedy. This is science fiction. And this is a rather mordant social commentary. So there's different things to cogitate after you've seen it each time, assuming you see it more than once. Well, what was wonderful about Carl and Steve's story was that the premise was also the plot. The theme and the narrative were inextricable. All you had to do was walk the guy down a street, and you would see the world through his eyes, through fresh eyes.
You know, you don't see anymore these days, do you, a character allowed to be on the screen alone, just to, you know, for the audience, just to see somebody with their defenses down. It's so interesting. We're in the world of the quick cuts now, and they don't allow the characters to develop.
Well, it's your city. I'll leave it up to you.
I know. Something was just you. Don't worry. It's perfectly safe. We haven't had any trouble since the big one in 1906. Knockwood.
The big one?
The earthquake. Don't you know about that?
Look at that. Incredible. It's beautifully lit. It's very well lit.
This is Paul Lohman at his best, if you look at Mary. This was a revolving restaurant. It was a five-page scene, and the restaurant was going to open, so we had, I don't know, 2 hours of actual shooting time, and everybody said, you know, you'll never get it. And I said, if they know their lines and we don't fool around with a lot of extraneous shots, we will get it. I mean, so it's close-ups, overs, and a angle, you know, featuring both of them. And we did it. You can't do it unless your actors are really troopers.
And we went through the whole scene one go.
When I left,
Is that where you found London? Everybody...
I know, everybody got very excited when they saw the dailies of this. They were all... And this is, I think, halfway through the shoot. It was somewhere like that.
It seems to me that if it's a love story, then people have to fall in love. It means, you know, you need to look at somebody and listen to what they're saying and stare at them and let them stare at you.
You know, really, it is a romance. Honestly, the movie, if you ask me what it is, it's a romance, really. And the Jack the Ripper thing is a byproduct, really. But the main thrust of the film is the romantic element between these two. And that's what, you know, it's the hat that we can hang everything on. I think I did actually tell her that I loved her before we started this scene. And I think that, I don't know whether it was a calculated thing on my part or not, but I think it sent her into a bit of a spin. And myself too, because I thought, oh my God, what did I say? And then we had to do the scene, and actually it was the best thing that ever happened. She is so delightful in this part, I think. She had been trained at in New York at the neighborhood playhouse with Sandy Meisner. And then, you know, she was a waitress at the Magic Pan and for 6 years, going up for parts, you know, and all the usual thing is very difficult. And she always got close, and then... I remember she went to see Jack Nicholson, but the casting, I think they said, look, you're not the right type. You know, she went anyway, and she just sat there in the sort of foyer of the office. And all she was just looked down. She wouldn't look up, and all she saw was a pair of boots, and they were Jack's boots. And he said, have her in. And... you know, she did a great read for him, and that was it. It's amazing. She's, of course, from North Little Rock, Arkansas.
It's not women's lib. I just get nervous. When I get nervous, I tend to...
There was a lot more dialogue in this scene, and we kept shortening it and shortening it and shortening it. I don't think I missed anything. I've discovered that the attrition rate for dialogue in a movie that I write and direct, from first draft to answer print of the movie... is 50%. 50% of the words are going to go. This used to bug me until I realized that I could save my best lines and use them in other movies. And I've done that a bunch. I keep waiting and waiting and waiting. And I had a line that I wrote in some movie where somebody says, I don't believe in God. And the other guy says, it's okay, God believes in you. And I kept using that in movie after movie, and never got in. And finally, in The Count of Monte Cristo with James Caviezel and Richard Harris, there it is. I finally worked it in.
The motor car sequence.
Here we have the intricacies of motoring, which are going to play such an important part in our story.
He's trying to figure it out.
Lucky thing, if he didn't drive a stick shift, we'd still be there.
Well, Nick had to put in a few shots of that because, of course, there's a thing coming up where I actually drive the thing.
Accelerate while the left retards our speed.
Of course.
Retards our speed. It's a wonderful dialogue, isn't it, really? It's just the flavor of it. It's not really, I mean, just the flavor, and it's just the right amount. Just beautifully done.
My husband used to drive in a stock car rally. He taught me good.
Muir Woods.
This is Muir Woods, one of my favorite locations. Mm. It's near Sausalito. It's across the bridge. You mentioned it's featured also, I had forgotten, but it is featured in Vertigo. And this is one of my favorite lines, but it never gets a laugh because people are too wrapped up in the romance.
I'm kidding. How old do you think I am?
Oh, I'm sorry. The Third World War?
The Vietnam War.
Mary has incredible delivery. I mean, it's so unique.
He wanted me to give up work and have children, you know? The house.
These are wonderful redwoods Some of them are very, very huge. And this is where the UN Charter was signed and consecrated, is in Muir Woods, and there's a little placard there. But if you've never been to Muir Woods and you get the chance, you should definitely check out this place. This is not Muir Woods. We didn't get it all in one day, and so we grabbed this somewhere else. But the other scenes, and there were many more.
As a matter of fact, I'm also divorced for a similar reason.
She wanted you to be a housewife?
She wanted me to be routine.
Oh. Well, that is one thing you definitely are not. I don't know what it is. First, I thought it was your voice, or maybe your clothes. Now, I don't know. Maybe it's that kind of little boy lost quality you give off. Brings up.
I suppose that when you're reading the scene, you don't really think that it's in terms of reverse of the role. But, of course, you know, that here's a man who's, you know, fish out of water, and to a certain extent, Mary, who is the modern woman, who's rather aggressive, if you like, and very positive and everything. And so that, of course, she does take on more the masculine sort of side. And look at this. Here they are in a cinema and in a movie house, and there's HG's under the floor.
Little did we know, it should have been Exorcist 8, but...
We all got a good laugh out of that.
I mean, I'm sure we had to pick a movie that we could use the title of, so we picked a Warner's movie.
I really got off on that. Careers. It's almost 6. Do you have plans for the evening?
Well, actually, I haven't made any.
Are you tired of me yet?
No, not in the least.
Great. How about... I cook you dinner. I don't live too far from
you. Sure, it's not too much trouble.
Are you kidding? I'm happy.
This is all San Francisco. The only thing so far I've recognized as being a set was the Wells' house.
Mm-hmm.
And the hotel room. And this is, again, this is the Palace of Fine Arts.
Yeah.
They built that for the Pan American Exposition.
She describes it quite right. Built for the Pan American Exposition. And I thought, we have to work this into the movie.
You don't have anything like this in London, right?
You've never seen the Albert Hall.
Oh, well, hell, I've never even been to London.
Where do you live?
This way. You should see this place when they turn the lights on at night.
Is it marble?
Wouldn't you believe plastic?
This is a set. This is back on Warner Brothers.
I had to do a lot of reacting to modern... every single thing with an engine or a computer chip.
I know that's terrible, but I just don't...
Of course, it was before the internet.
I never have time, and when I do, it seems easier to watch the TV, even though that's mainly crap.
What's that?
The phone. Ted's idea.
She hated the Mickey Mouse phone.
She said, my character would never have that phone. And I had to agree with her, actually. It was a gag. I agreed with her on this. She was very upset.
And I said, Mary, I need to have the Mickey Mouse phone. And she stormed off and then came back a day or so later and said, okay, I know how to make it work for you. And so when she acknowledges the phone, she says under her breath, Ted's idea. Ted being her divorced husband. So she had justified not only the phone, but the divorce.
She wants to marry into oil. This is almost ready. I wonder if you mind if I change my clothes, because I've been in my work clothes all day. I really won't be a minute.
No, please, please, you go right ahead.
You know that H.G. Wells was a great socialite and one of the first believers in women's liberation and all the rest of it. So it was really interesting to see how he would react when he actually met a liberated woman.
You look very beautiful.
and she puts the glass down in her spaghetti, but I didn't film that right. Needed a close-up of the glass going into the spaghetti. As I was saying, I'm not terribly interested, and never was, a Jack the Ripper buff. I just was interested in what he represented. I'm not interested in Wells. I was interested in what he represented. The two sides of the human coin. Constructive and destructive. And here we have a switcheroo on the Your Beautiful Miss Jones scene, where somebody takes the glasses off the girl, but we flipped it around. When I say we, I guess I mean me. They're so convincing here. I thought I was such a great director.
That's very Lindsay Anderson. Lindsay said, before you, when you do a kiss on screen, when you go in, come back and just mark it and then go in. Every screen kiss I think I've ever done, I've always learned to do it that way.
Well, Miss Jones, you're gorgeous.
I think the only person knew that we were falling in love was the sound man, who sometimes left those mics on. And there'd be whispered moments occasionally, and then we'd have to pretend that, you know, we were completely indifferent to each other and all that.
Asking people, asking the artist where things came from is a really difficult question to answer, because the truth is, no matter what they tell you, and they may tell you many colorful anecdotes. You know, Gilbert says, I got the idea to write the Mikado when a Japanese sword hanging on my wall fell down and almost decapitated me. That's a good story. It may even be true. But it simply doesn't explain how he wrote the Mikado. It's just an anecdote. And the truth is that creative people are unable to describe where the creative stuff comes from, which makes it very difficult when you're dealing with executives who want to know, why did you make this choice? And I say, I don't know, boss, but I made it because I made it. I think it works. But I can't intellectualize it. I cannot give you the cerebral underpinnings of it, because it's made from the gut, not from the head. That's why I can't say what this movie is, or any movie I made is. Is it a political film? Is it a this? Is it a that? I said, no. You can say what you intended it to be, what I thought I was doing, what I hoped I was doing. And anybody who, you know, gives you definitive answers is, in a way, misleading you as to what the creative process is. An artist, a filmmaker, a writer, a painter, these are all people who are putting a message in a bottle. I put the message in the bottle. Then I throw the bottle into the water, and that's the only control I have over it. I can only hope that the bottle is discovered, that somebody opens it, pulls out the message, and is able to decipher what's there. I certainly will not be around to say, it's a political message, it's a social message, it's a this, it's a that. When I said before, this movie operates on five levels, did I go in there thinking it was going to operate on five levels? Not really. Semi-something. But you sort of learn about these things as you do them, which is another thing that makes executives crazy, because they're not interested in experimentation. Want to know what we're spending the money on. I don't blame them.
That's her sister, by the way, in that scene, in that photograph.
Got a lot of complaints about this. She brushes her hair in the kitchen. And I suppose that was a no-no, but again, I sort of wanted her lifting up her hair at that moment. I didn't know where else to go with it.
No idea what's to be done.
You say you're after this man. Are you a detective or something? You work for Scotland Yard?
Well, let's just say that their interests are definitely involved.
I don't understand. Why can't you just go to the police, tell them who they're looking for?
As I watch the movie, I find myself caught up in what's going on and reluctant to interrupt it.
You'd never believe me.
I'd believe you.
Well, they wouldn't. If I told them the whole truth, they'd pack me off to a lunatic asylum and not him.
I led you to him, didn't I?
What were you doing, visiting bank after bank? Would you have gone to bed with anybody who told you where he was?
Amy.
I think he was having a great time, basically. He was nervous because he knew I didn't know what I was doing. And it was his first American movie. He had always made in English movies before, so it represented a big step. But he trusted the script. Ultimately, he trusted me. And he was crazy about her. So what could be bad? Everybody working on this movie was having a great time.
Absolutely. It was fun. I don't know how to help you. It was a lot of fun, actually. Being in San Francisco, and then I remember when we came back to Warner Brothers, and I remember walking down that street with Mary, actually, and there were the lampposts, the Singing in the Rain, and I remember going up, and I was doing it, you know. I grabbed over the lamppost, and the damn thing fell over. Oh, my God. But it was a wonderful time in one's life, actually. And looking at it now, you can see these people are in love, actually. Either that or very good acting.
And we're going to go up here to the store. Paul Lohman, who shot this, as I said, was a real classicist, and he hated the use of the zoom. And at one point when they're searching Wells' house, there's a snapback zoom that I wanted. And, oh, he was walking up and down and saying, Meyer, this is terrible, this is stinks. And I said, I don't know how to tell them that the room is empty faster than this. But basically, when they invented the zoom, and you see movies from the period, that zoom is all over the place, and it looks terribly dated now, those push-in snap-outs. So I'm glad we had only one of them.
I don't know, you tell me. You're the one who took off the whole afternoon.
In one word, fabulous. Mm-hmm. I just can't describe it.
On second thought, please don't try. He may just die of envy.
Well, I want you to meet him. Could you come for dinner Friday night around 7? I'm sure it'll be fine with Herbert.
Herbert? Oh, you must really be hooked. I think so. I'll just check my busy social calendar. Talk to you later.
Hello again. I've come to change some more currency.
Oh. Yes, of course. How much did you have in mind to exchange this time?
Oh, say 40 guineas.
I figured if you're gonna talk about a money belt, one thing that interests me is that people say things in movies and audiences don't hear them. I can tell you that if you're showing two people having a conversation and one person says something, but you cut to the other person listening to what they're saying, you will not hear what is being said. You will only concentrate on the person listening. And editors love to cut to reaction shots.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's important information or an important idea, don't do it, because you won't hear what the line is. Here's the payoff for Mickey Mouse.
What?
He's right at my desk with the money belt.
So I noticed when I went to see Lord of the Rings that I couldn't understand the characters' names. They kept saying them, but I thought, oh gosh, if I could only see it written out, I would know what the name is. It sounded hard, it was hard for me to make out. So if you say money belt, I don't know if you know what a money belt is. And
I'm on my way right now.
So I showed the money belt.
What?
Or maybe that's just a big rationalization, I don't know. Maybe I can lose some of those money belt shots.
Sorry about that, I was just
touching. And here we have a great scare moment. Two, in fact.
They fluctuate every day, I wouldn't want you to get sick. Are you enjoying your stay in San Francisco?
Very much.
Wonderful, wonderful. Did they find room for you at the Hyatt Regency?
Yes, thanks to you.
Uh-oh. Thanks to you. Now he's putting it together.
Thanks to you.
You wouldn't happen to know a man called Wells, would you? I thought so. Amy Robbins.
Maybe I should have. Cut to the sign. There's another close-up missing. I don't know. You get away without them, but should we have cut to the sign, Amy Robbins? Maybe it would have been better.
I don't think I'll conduct my business here anymore if it's all the same to you. Good day.
This next bit is stolen, but I can't remember what movie I stole it from.
One other item.
David always was coming up to me before scenes and going to me with his hands pressed together. Short takes, short takes. And I didn't know the difference between a short take and a long take. And I said, well, you know, why does it have to be a short take? And he was always worried about whether he would know his lines. And finally, at the end of the movie, when I was really cocky about what I was doing and how much fun we were having, and I said to him, David, why do you keep saying short takes? You played Hamlet 4 hours. You remembered all your lines. You don't have any problems. You've never missed a line in this movie. And he looked at me, he goes, well, that's part of the process then, isn't it? And that put the idea in my head that they have a process.
I love the fact that there was lots of movement and rushing about and all that. It was very much the essence of the character. It sort of modernized him a bit. I don't know whether Victorians ran in a different way. I think they sort of did, but... I think for H.G. Wells, he had to be. It's very energetic, you know. He would have been a wonderful scoutmaster.
This is a set. This is Warner Brothers.
Dr. Stevenson.
Yes.
Stevenson is responsible for the death of these two girls.
I just know for a fact that he is.
I see. Do you have spiritual powers?
Do I what?
Have spiritual powers? Are you a medium or a mystic?
I make no claim to supernatural gifts of any sort. If I could reveal the source of my information. As a matter of fact, I'm also a detective. I sent here from London on the trail of John Leslie Stevenson, traveling incognito.
Here was another suggestion. My focus puller said, hey, I can program this machine to print this stuff out. And I said, great, let's do that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had that shot either.
My name is Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes, I see.
Well, he never thought that Sherlock Holmes would stay popular. He thought it was just like a... the only detective he could think of. Who knew he was going to last 100 years?
I told you everything that I know.
Well, it was certainly very good of you to come in and share your insight with us, Mr. Holmes. Now, where can we reach you in case we want to speak with you again?
Is that necessary? It's rather awkward. I'm staying with a friend.
I do remember that I had to come in and beg for her life, for Amy's life, in front of Stevenson. And I had to really get very emotional and start to cry, and so I used these ammonium capsules to sniff, and my God, they get your attention, right? It's like smelling salts, and actors use it, you know, to tear up and stuff. So I'd go behind the piece of scenery, take a sniff of this thing, come on, do the scene, and Mary came up afterwards and said, oh my God, that was so brilliant. I don't know how you got in the... And I'm going, yes, I think, thanks very much. And do it again. On, oh, please, spare, you know, the whole thing. I mean, and I'm just, she's absolutely amazed, you know. Anyway, I'm just about to do it again. She pops around and goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm just taking a sniff of it. She was furious. That's not acting. I said, no. I'm sorry. That is acting. That's exactly what it is. Anyway, so cut about a week later. She thought that was really a ham-fisted cheat, not really acting. That's terrible. We're waiting to go. I'm waiting for her to go out to dinner, right? She had an emotional scene in the car, and she couldn't get the thing. So they would take up, say, I went up to the makeup, borrowed a capsule, went over to her, and I said, here, crack, sniff this. She went, oh, boom. One take, we were out of there. I said, well, are we going to use that again? Huh? Are you learning a few tricks here?
All right, I'm going to tell you the truth. In the first place, my name isn't Herbert Wells. It's Herbert George Wells. H.G. Wells. In the second place, I'm 113 years old.
It's impossible for Wells to evaluate the 20th century because he's polluted it.
Yeah.
So he's a man on a mission, and he really doesn't have time to stop and admire either approvingly or disapprovingly the scenery, aside from her, who's mixed up in his quest.
You don't believe me?
Christ, Herbert, what do you think? Please go away. I don't want to see you anymore.
Amy, please, Amy, listen to me.
I have listened to you. Herbert, the crooked shit I never heard. Look, I don't know if you're crazy or what, but anyway, I don't care. Just go back to whatever hole you crawled out of. Go back to your machine.
Amy. Wait, Amy!
I write very good dialogue. I'll give myself that. I could write Victorian dialogue, and I could write 20th century dialogue, and it is the clash of the two which lends, to my way of thinking, the film part of its piquancy. He speaks perfect English. He is grammatically correct. She's a like-I-said person.
There is an H.G. Wells exhibit with Time Machine. All right. There is some resemblance between you and the man in those pictures.
The museum is closing.
But that doesn't prove anything.
The museum is closing.
Now what?
I want you to go to the powder room.
The museum is closing.
This is Patty Darbinville. Very good actress. Wonderful.
I think most women were turned off because they pushed the sort of Jack the Ripper stuff, and it's not, that's really an element, an important element, but not the main thrust of the movie. So I think we lost out greatly, and I think that's been proved because it's an enduring film, and people see it again and again and again, and new generations discover it, and they think it's great, you know.
I, Claudius made a big impression on me. I loved I, Claudius. And I, Claudius was the only time I ever screamed in front of a television screen. And it's when they were coming to chop off Messalina's head. And the camera did this big swish as the knife went through the air. And I decided to borrow that, but I added something to it.
David, she's absolutely brilliant, and I'm really in awe of his performance. I think he's a great actor, but he's great in this. I didn't realize quite how great, but nice to see it again.
Later than you think.
The tear was my addition. Don't borrow something unless you can add to it or subtract from it or find some way to make it your own. Again, I'm not wild about the way all this was shot, but this is a real museum. This is the Oakland Museum.
Every single part, I always look for the comedic element, and that, because even at the most heavy, if you can break it with any kind of smile or, you know, fun side or comedic element in any way, then you're giving a whole nother dimension to the character and possibly to the scene. So it's very important, especially with him, because he's, you know, it's funny to see this. You've got to play that a bit, you know, to see this man out of his element and, you know, going around like a complete idiot, you know. But it's fun for us to watch that and see, and just his movements and stuff and all that. You've got to join in with the fun of it, you know, and go with it a bit. I think that if you at all make the audience come out of it, it's gone. You're dead. So you have to play it very, very straight and earnestly and make them believe all the way down the line. And let the right, trust the writing, really.
Suppose we just go forward to this Saturday. How would that be?
Just fine. My cleaning's due back.
And that would make it November the 10th. Now, don't expect too much. The entire voyage will only last about a quarter of a second. You ready?
Come on.
Well, we're here.
Good. Can we go now, please?
You still maintain this is all poppycock?
That wasn't exactly the word I had in mind.
This was in the museum, I think, itself.
When I did Star Trek IV and Spock looks out the window when they've done their time trip to Earth and somebody says, "When are we?" And he says, "Judging from the pollution content in the atmosphere, we're in the late 20th century." And here's where music sells the miracle. Were Tristan and Isolde. Should have had a close up. Have a nosebleed here. I thought she should, I don't know why, again, it just seemed right. And she fought me, and I said, okay, we won't do it. But I thought somehow, you know, if you get badly enough shocked that something goes wrong physically, well, vomit, I mean, that's a cliche, you know, just a nosebleed. I just thought was weirder. I'm always trying to be off center. When she turns around and says, "This is a crock of shit," you're surprised. Because it came out of her mouth. And it hasn't been that movie so far.
You know, we could easily avoid this whole thing.
You mean give him the key?
No. I mean come back with me.
Back?
Yes. Back to 1893.
I'm a 20th century woman. I have a career and a mind of my own. Be reasonable. How am I going to make it in 1893?
Is your work so important? It's your life we're talking about.
My work is my life. As much as yours or any other man's.
It's quite a dilemma, isn't it, really? Would anyone want to go back in time? Not many. Not many, because I think the advances in medicine alone. It's strange, though. The main thing is, you know, I'm a fish out of water. I'm from this period into this period. So let's see how much fun we can get out of it. And let's see, even in times of stress, I see my eyes wander to the calculator. You know, you've got to be aware of it the whole time. It's just never ending. So, and that sense of, you know, wonderment and stuff. But I try to vary it a bit because, you know, you get bored doing the same look. I mean, you've got to find other things to do. So, you know, that's basically it, just trying to find a range of stuff. It's like an onion, you know, you start to peel it, and there's so many rings, and you know, before you get to the core of it.
Don't
This movie was not a time travel movie per se, other than to get you from point A to point B and...
Oh, yeah.
And I guess allegedly back again. This was about, you know, three people running around San Francisco, two of them from 1893. How they got there, less important than why they got there. You know, Hitchcock used to call it the MacGuffin. It's the thing. It got you there. Enough. If the movie had been a movie about people traveling from one time to another, to another, to another, then yes, it's a special effects fans in a different picture. If the story had been, for example, if we had followed the novel of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine and gone far into the future and met the Eloi and the Morlocks, then those fantasy elements would be appropriate. But I don't know what else to have put in. I put in what I thought I needed to tell the story. It's like that scene in Amadeus where the emperor tries to tell Mozart that there were too many notes, and he goes, no, there were just as many notes as I needed, and there were no more.
There aren't any sporting goods stores open this time of night.
Whatever for?
So we could buy a gun. It's dangerous in case you hadn't heard.
Well, I wouldn't purchase a weapon now, even if I could.
Oh, what is this, Victorian chivalry or something? We're playing for keeps here.
Exactly. And Stevenson was right about one thing. Violence.
I remember when I starred in my first film that was recognized and all the rest of it, and I remember insisting to every interviewer that would listen that, I didn't want to be a film star. I wanted to be an actor, and I wanted to be just like John Gielgud, you know, doing parts in his 70s, 80s, and actually went on to his 90s. I heard a story that he actually called his agent when he was 93 and said, "Is there anything for me?" And that is delightful, isn't it? It never goes away, you know. He was such a great actor. And somebody like John Gielgud changed. You know, he learned how to act on film. And he became a great, great film actor. So I'd rather be here for the long haul. Sometimes the career's up, sometimes it's down. But at least you're around through the generations, you know, that's important because that's more the English way. It's to be a professional actor is, that's a noble profession and that's meaningful and means something. But it means that you have to change as you get older, as you do as a person, you change as an actor too. And that has to obviously go hand in glove. So, you know, don't start getting facelifts or dyeing the hair and... You are what you are, and if you want to be a character actor, I mean, it's a great privilege to be a character actor, you know, go with it and accept the age and accept the lines, you know, you've earned them. And she changes attire. Girls can do anything, even if we're not supposed to call them girls. Yeah, you said, the roles have been reversed. Of course, every phone is out of order, naturally.
Should have had a close-up of the out-of-order sign.
Get that? McLaren Park. Get there as soon as possible. What?
Every little thing I had to remember. Don't look too comfortable with anything. in every single scene, whatever it was that you were doing, you had to always be aware of the fact that, you know, every single thing around him was new to him, and so that either holding the phone or whatever it is, just using any modern convenience or appliance or whatever, to him it's a wonderment.
I look for things that are visually arresting. Science fiction and movies are media are genres that are made for each other, because science fiction, give it another word, fantasy. I mean, stop being so literal about it, whether it's science fiction or it's fantasy or it's heavy metal or whatever it is. It's just that pictorially things get very interesting. Period films do that. I like to watch a Western because it's a window on a world that is not literally our own. Lawrence of Arabia, The Bridge on the River Kwai, war movies do that because they take you to some place that they can only take you. And the great thing about movies is that movies can make you interested in things that you never thought you'd be interested in a million years. If I said, you know, I want to make a movie about women's Major League Baseball, and, you know, and I think, oh, I don't think I want to see that. And yet, when I watched it for 2 hours, the most important thing in my life, and there was another picture, I think it was a Warner's picture called Sounder. I think Warner's made Sounder. And if you said to me, oh, I'll do a picture about, you know, sharecroppers in Louisiana during the Depression, I would say, well, that sounds kind of unexciting or uninteresting. And then you see the movie, and you can't get that movie out of your head, and you can't stop watching it, and for 2 hours it's all you want to see. But it's not what is familiar, is what you see on the 6 o'clock news when you, or the police car going by, you know, which is not to say that, you know, I didn't love Serpico, I didn't love Dog Day Afternoon, but when they take you into another place, that's when I get interested. I don't sit there watching the Sci-Fi Channel because variety is the spice of life, and if science fiction always means outer space, if it always means the aliens, then I get tired of that.
If I'm not back in an hour, then you register at the Huntington Hotel, and you've got the car.
You promise you'll be back to
promise. I promise. And you try and get some rest.
Yes.
A little brandy in the flask if you need it.
That's right. I have some Valium. Sedatives.
All right. Try and get some rest.
Malcolm hurt his ankle, so somebody else is doing this running. He had sprained his ankle or something. Actors, you can't take your eyes off of him. I don't know what he had done to himself or when he had done it. Our hero has been reduced to foregoing his credo. We've reached a dreadful point.
Hey, what is the meaning of this? Shut up!
And we found some very nice people who let us put cameras in their bedroom because the only way to get this next shot. That.
For a first-time director, amazing. Brilliant job.
And now we remember that there's a doorknob that doesn't really close the door. Making movies, if you ever get to do it, is or ought to be a lot of fun. As Orson Welles said, it's the biggest set of electric trains any kid was ever given to play with. And as a writer, by the time I'm finished writing the script, I'm tired of being by myself. And I like the familial and the collaborative part of movie making. By the time the movie is over, I'm partied out. I'm ready to go back to my little cabin. So they're sort of supplementary or complementary endeavors. When you're writing, you're only limited by your own abilities. That's kind of nice. But you're all alone. When you're making a movie, you're always dependent on a million wild cards, people, weather, budgets, world events. But at least you got company in the trenches.
And the thing is about film acting, for me, is that it has to be a lot of fun. It has to be enjoyable, because if that light is going to go on behind the eyes, and there's got to be that twinkle there, it can only be done, and you can only find that feeling with total fun and enjoyment of the character and the process. Picasso said it took him 70 years to learn how to draw a straight line. And in a weird way, the more that you know, the more you have to forget and let spontaneity and intuition take over. And I think that's the secret, in a way, for me anyway, of growing up with the work and changing with the work. You know, after another 10 years or so, it changes enormously. You know, you change the person and you change as an actor, and you've got to keep that in sync. So it goes with what I was saying before about, you know, having a facelift and dyeing your hair. Well, that's okay too. There's nothing wrong with that. But I just figure the way I feel is, you know, that I've earned the lines, and the lines on the face, that is, and I'm happy to keep them.
Take a look, you cretinous idiot. This is tomorrow's bloody paper.
It's the one time where Wells can use a little of his power. I mean, I'm having to hold back, you know. And it's just the one little glimpse of Wells as a, you know, when pushed right into a corner, could strike back pretty hard.
Now, where did you get the gun?
A lot of times an actor will say to you, oh, I don't think I should do this. At the end, Malcolm said, I don't think I should cry. I don't think I should fall on my knees at the end. And we got there, and I said, oh, so what will you do? Because he's going to kill her. And he wound up crying and falling on his knees. So they wind up doing it, even though they... Now, this is my giant doorknob. This is what I meant by getting confident. I had them build me this humongous doorknob, and everybody thought I was crazy, but it's nice when it happens. My other idea, obviously, was that the angles in the police station get crazier and crazier. Again, I don't know why they get crazier and crazier. It just felt right.
Yeah. In that sequence, yeah. No, he helped tremendously with all that. And he had some interesting angles and stuff.
Now, please send a car to 2340 Francisco. Send the car and I'll sign whatever you want.
Very good performance from him.
Yeah. This is was a process shot. They weren't in the car. Said, oh God, why'd you put the hand there? And I said, do you think she was dead when you saw the hand? They said, yeah. I said, that's why I put it there.
You're free to go. I'm sorry. Please believe me, I am truly sorry.
Very well crafted script, though. Every little nuance and all this stuff now is in shock. And
the more I do this stuff, the more the visual aspects of it become clearer to me in their order of importance.
First time he's walking. But look at how wonderful this character of the Palace of Fine Arts looks at night. The music box is great.
The idea here was that this was all to be fogged in. We were going to fog it all in so it would be like the opening of the movie. But there was too much wind, and we couldn't do the fog.
You murdered Carol, my friend, from work. I forgot him.
Maybe we should have done a close-up. I'm sure I did. Why didn't we use it? I don't know why.
Anything?
The newspaper was wrong.
Amy? Not so fast.
Some things look better on the big screen than they look when you see them on a TV screen. They get a little small.
You know what I want? Give me the key. And you get the White Queen. All right. All right. You let her go and I'll throw it to you.
Oh, no. My mother was rather an atrocious woman in her way, but her many failings did not include raising mentally deficient sons.
You throw me the key and I'll release the girl.
On your honor, John.
You have my word as a gentleman.
Very important, Edwardian gentleman. Your word is your bond, and that's a contract, you know. Except that Stevenson, of course, is now a modern man.
Warner Brothers wanted me to reshoot this. They wanted her to be more messed up. But she wasn't there when he made the murder.
I would have expected that you'd know
so
by now that I am.
I sort of held to what I thought. She looks kind of whacked out anyway at this point. I didn't think you needed it. Or maybe I was just being stubborn.
Now this puts a little bit more fun into it.
You know where we're going.
And now another element pays off. I always thought this script should have won an Oscar. I thought it was a really good script, and then it didn't even get nominated. The primary purpose of art, as I think I've said, is to make you feel things. And then the best art makes you think about what you felt later. So I would hope that people who watch Time After Time have a great time while they're watching it, and then find when it's over that the movie stays with them for whatever reasons, and maybe they, you know, remember that television scene or remember some of the social commentary which informs what's going on, or maybe they don't, but maybe they see it enough to want to see it again, and those other aspects make themselves felt on repeated viewings. I don't think that's a fair criterion, by the way. I think that the movie has to make its impact on the assumption that people see it once. Again, this is the kind of scene that a more experienced director, I think, would have rendered far better. But it's sort of okay because, again, the narrative is so interesting. Steve Jaffe, Herb's son, who was the second unit director, did some of these hairier shots. And he was experienced, which is why they look so good.
This is I didn't realize just how great the score was. I must say, that's the
wonderful
thing I'm really amazed about now. How beautiful it is.
If I go any faster, I'm going to wrap it around a phone pole.
And here's a little mistake, as far as I'm concerned. What you really should see by the time they reach the top of the step is you should see the other car pulling in. But I didn't time it out right. And then this is the California Aquarium in Golden Gate Park.
And this is the studio, I think. Yeah.
What is it, HG? You're becoming extremely tiresome.
The girl.
Which girl? What do you mean, this one?
Let her go, please, I beg you.
David didn't know how to do this scene, and we kept fooling around with it. As I said, Malcolm didn't want to cry and get on his knees, but eventually he did. This scene came into focus for David when I said, "You're exhausted." And once I said that, he knew how to play the scene. Confused.
Right now, then. No. Please. John, you and I, we were friends once. I admired you.
Oh, what are you babbling about, Wells? Really, you've become quite an old fool, haven't you?
Yes, I am an old fool. I know that.
In Greek tragedy, which is where I sort of come from, the key moment, the moment of peripeteia, is when the hero realizes that everything he knows is wrong. So I was trying to get to that place.
I had to make him believe that he'd won, obviously, and that she was worthless, not even worth him killing. And of course, it's...
Checkmate, you've lost again.
She's the most valuable thing in his life.
And here, something was supposed to happen that I didn't photograph right, which was his watch getting hooked on the same silly hook that HG's got hooked on when he arrived. Not quite clear what happened there. And I know what was supposed to happen. And now another payoff.
It's a great look, isn't it?
And that little nod, stolen from the third man. And originally, they said, well, these effects are not complete. And I said, well, I like them the way they are. I like him. I like the rotoscope black hole thing. Why don't we just leave it like that? So we did, because no one had ever seen that before. So it looked weird, bad. I was certainly influenced, at least visually, by the time travel sequence in the George Powell movie of the time machine. I didn't know enough to be able to replicate it completely, which was maybe a good thing because I was forced to replicate it differently and try other ways of depicting time travel, but I certainly used it as my jumping off point. I mean, you know, the sky turning and all the clocks racing around and stuff like that. If that wasn't in the original time machine movie, it should have been.
I never saw the original time machine, but I know, it's a classic, isn't it? And yes, I've seen snippets of it on television, of course, but I've never actually sat down and watched it. And I always said to myself, I must do that, and never got round to it, of course.
Finally, I must go back because that is where I belong. And my life is almost as important to me as yours.
A lot of people really love this film, and it has a tremendous hardcore fan base, you know, that, and I can see why. It's the most charming film. And having seen it again after all these years, it holds up beautifully well, and every element works. And it's just a fabulous thing. I'm so glad that I managed to, you know, be cast. Thank you, Nick. Again.
Wait for me, Tommy! Oh, it's a life without you. Please! Just don't expect miracles. I'm changing my name to Susan B. Anthony.
I'm saying, who is Susan B. Anthony? Who's this? I have no idea. I didn't know any American history, really, that time. You know, if she went back to Edwardian England, she'd be very miserable. is what I think.
Everything in the cards is true. She was his cousin.
I'm just amazed at how well this film stands up. I'm very proud of it, and everybody in it, of course, Mary, fabulous, and David. I will call him tonight and tell him how brilliant he was in this film, and Nick Meyer's script and his direction, and the music, the lighting, every single element is fantastic.
I'm very proud of it. I think there are many things that I can point to and did point to that are wrong with it, but I think it holds up very well. I think it's smart. I think it's sweet. I think it's exciting. I don't think at the moment it's dated particularly. Maybe I wish it were prettier. Maybe I wish there were more close-ups. It also was just about the happiest experience I ever had making a film, and the fact that it turned out so well and was so well loved makes me very pleased. I think there's an enormous sweetness to the whole enterprise, gore notwithstanding.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to see this film again, and it was an amazing period, short time, that's sort of 3 months in my life. You know, I fell in love on film. I mean, that's staggering. So Mary's right when she says, to our kids, if you want to see how Dad and I were when we were falling in love, just go rent Time After Time.
The world that is depicted in this movie, put aside the time travel stuff, is a world that we recognize all too well, I might add. I think it was a good story, well enough told.